We're discussing the unfolding situation in Ukraine and the threat of Russia amassing tens of thousands of troops around Ukraine's borders. How will the U.S. respond? It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told CNN Sunday that Russian President Vladimir Putin has a range of things he could do, and there are two paths, one being diplomacy and dialogue. But Blinken said the U.S. is prepared to deal with, quote, renewed aggression and massive consequences.
If a single additional Russian force goes into Ukraine in an aggressive way, as I said, that would trigger a swift, a severe, and a united response from us and from Europe.
What do you want to know about Ukraine? Should the U.S. be involved? 800-642-1234. Ted Gerber is a professor of sociology, directs the Wisconsin Russia Project for UW-Madison Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia. Ted, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good morning. So starting with the ordered departure of family members of staff at the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine, State Department advising Americans to consider departing immediately. State Department also reissuing its advisory for Russia, warning Americans not to travel due to volatility. What does that signal to you about this moment and the potential for military action?
Well, it signals that the U.S. government really is taking seriously possibility that we may see some military action in the coming weeks. It's a fairly standard procedure, I should note, so it's important not to be to interpret it with too much alarm. However, the situation really is quite dangerous and risky, and everybody should be concerned about the possibility of military fighting actually breaking out in Ukraine.
Back up for us, if you could, with context. Why is Russia threatening Ukraine?
Well, okay, so we could go back a long, way back in history, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go back to the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. So at that time, as many of your listeners may recall, but some may not, the Ukraine was one of 15 different republics of the Soviet Union, and it became an independent country. However, Ukraine has long been considered by Russians to be really a kind of a younger cousin or younger brother type of a state and society. And so it really irked the Russian leaders that they lost Ukraine. And so then moving forward, when the Russian economy and society underwent a lot of trauma in the 1990s, as a result of market reforms and the loss of the Russian Empire and the chaos that ensued, then when Vladimir Putin became president in 2000, he quickly chose as one of his main objectives to restore Russian pride, Russian national power, and that included, among other things, re-establishing Russian control over Ukraine, which has not been easy. The Ukrainians themselves have not really cooperated with this plan. They at various times have elected Western-oriented leaders. And as a result, was probably most people are aware, in 2014, Russia then annexed Crimea, which was a major part of Ukraine, a big peninsula in the Black Sea. And then it supported secessionist rebels in the eastern area of the Donbass region. So the question then becomes, why now? And I think there are several factors, most of which have been discussed, but some of which I think have not been emphasized enough.
Well, I just want to pause right here because sure. Secretary of State Antony Blinken keeps making references to 2014 when Ukrainians ousted their pro-Russian president. And as you said, the Russian military crosses into Ukrainian territory and annexes Crimea. So how does that somewhat fresh recent history inform what is happening today?
Well, for one, the Russians basically got away with it. They annexed, part of a sovereign territory of a neighboring country against its will. They supported and continue to support armed conflict in which over 10,000 people have been killed, and a big swath of eastern swath of Ukraine consists of what the Ukrainians call the non-government controlled areas. So they're sort of They don't really belong to anyone. The Ukrainian government doesn't exercise authority over those regions. Mm. And although the U.S. raised a hue and cry and protested, there were really not too many serious consequences for the Russian government. Moreover, these actions led to a huge surge in the popularity, the personal popularity of Putin at a time when his ratings, so to speak, had been ebbing and declining. Hmm. So that must be considered a factor that is influencing Putin's thinking as to whether or not to renew military conflict in Ukraine.
I'm going to reintroduce you here. Ted Gerber with us, sociology professor at UW-Madison, focusing on Russia, Ukraine, other former Soviet countries. Also director of the Wisconsin-Russia Project for UW-Madison Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia. You can join in on the conflict, the situation, and what you see and what you wonder about. 800-642-1234. So what does Russia want from NATO here? Because NATO very much in the picture as the U.S. decides what its next step will be.
Well, Russia has made three demands, essentially. The first demand is that Russia wants NATO to guarantee that it will never allow Georgia or Ukraine to join NATO. It wants NATO to withdraw its forces from Western Europe. And it wants NATO to stop supporting, particularly providing any support to those new countries that joined after the Soviet collapse. So in the longer term, Russia has argued that it was essentially deceived by the United States. And we should be clear, I think although Russia addresses its demands to NATO, the way the Russians perceive the situation, NATO is really just an organization that does the bidding of the United States. That Russia perceives, Russia's way of understanding geopolitical conflict is that the United States is a global hegemon. It's a great superpower. And Russia also seeks that status. And other countries such as Ukraine, Poland, Czechoslovakia, these countries are just minor players that are pawns in this big conflict between the United States, Russia, and China. Hmm. So that's what Russia has demanded. And it must know that NATO is not going to accept those.
Let's just take a pause here and bring in Lisa in Madison. Lisa, hi. What would you like to bring up about NATO?
I'd just like to ask your guest how he sees the role that Trump played in weakening NATO and that emboldening Putin and what he's engaging in now, and also how this might be complicated, or what the role we see Michael Flynn and Tucker Carlson speaking with, engaging in Russian talking points on the air, and just how all these issues kind of interplay and where that puts us.
Lisa, thank you so much. Ted Gerber.
Excellent point. I think it's definitely the case that Trump's efforts to weaken NATO, his criticisms of the alliance, his sort of withdrawal, which raised a lot of uncertainty and concern on the part of the European members of NATO, has played into Russia's hands and has emboldened Putin. So if you're standing in Putin's position and you're looking at the world right now, it actually is a good time to assert Russian power. That Putin believes that the United States itself is internally divided. And you mentioned, some of the media coverage that plays, right into Russia's hands and touts Russian talking points. Well, that's just part of the picture that Putin, I think, rightly understands that right now there's a lot of internal disunity in the United States. There's a lack of political consensus. Any action that the U.S. government will take is going to be controversial because of the partisan nature of political debate in the United States. But of course, Putin also realizes that Biden is now in charge and Biden is president. And so far, Biden's withdrawal from Afghanistan, which was covered quite negatively by the media, it also speaks to this idea that the United States is at a point of general weakness and is not going to press back against any Russian actions. And that, of course, encourages Putin to consider taking action now. Hmm. Why wait until the United States can get its act together, which may or may not happen, but it might happen? Why wait until the U.S. is strengthened by greater unity and more resolve on the part of its leadership?
UW-Madison sociologist Ted Gerber with us directs the UW Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia as we discuss the evolving situation in Ukraine. How should the U.S. be involved amid rising tensions along the border? Should America send in ground troops to Ukraine? What about warships or aircraft? What are you watching for from NATO allies? 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Ted Gerber here on the Ideas Network. President Biden is weighing military options to counter Russian President Vladimir Putin's troop buildup and threats against Ukraine. We're talking about the situation on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Here's President Biden Thursday saying he has been absolutely clear with Putin and Putin has no misunderstanding about an invasion.
Let there be no doubt at all that if Putin makes this choice, Russia will pay a heavy price.
How big do you think is the risk of invasion? What do you think Russia wants from NATO? What would you do if you were President Biden and trying to negotiate with Putin? Join in 800-642-1234. UW-Madison sociologist Ted Gerber directs the Wisconsin Russia Project with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Martha now in Menominee. Hi, Martha. What's on your mind?
Yeah, see, I have customers in Kyiv and also Odessa, and I've been in contact with them, you know, inquiring what's the man on the street there? How are you feeling? Are you guys worried? And they consistently reply in the last, you know, week, 10 days that a lot of this is Putin's posturing and sort of the shark in the water, you know, smelling the blood in the water in the United States and poking a stick in the hornet's nest, you know, trying to stir something up because, in their words, and not mine, but in their feeling, Putin backed the right guy for president last time around. And so the turmoil in the U.S. is just, it's ripe for the picking. Mm. So I'd like to know if your expert has any feeling about if this is kind of the general feeling of the man on the street in Ukraine.
Martha, thank you. What do you make of this sentiment, Ted?
Well, that's a great question because it highlights the fact that Ukraine itself is a very diverse society with lots of internal disagreements among Ukrainian people, lots of frustration with their and in particular with its tendency for corruption and its inability to deal with the economic problems. And as a result, you're going to see division of opinions within Ukraine. Now, one result of Putin's 2014 annexation of Crimea and intervention in the eastern part of the country is, in fact, that had the unintended consequences, that is unintended by Putin, of bringing Ukrainians together around the issue of national sovereignty. And even though there are Ukrainians who are unhappy with the Western orientation of the current government and of some prior governments, although the government has vacillated between Western and Russian-oriented leaders, even though some may support the or oppose the Western orientation of the government, many Ukrainians most Ukrainians do not want Russia to invade, to take over part of their territory. And so the last incursion of Russia in 2014 had the impact of turning Ukrainian public opinion more solidly against Russia. Now, the current environment, I don't know what the array of opinions are, but I do think, I have been in contact myself with some of my colleagues and friends in Ukraine, and they are very worried about the possibility of an invasion. They don't have the sort of dismissive attitude that the caller referred to among her customers.
Blake from Madison called in, couldn't stay, but Blake wonders, how is COVID affecting the Russia-Ukraine situation or making things worse? How is the pandemic?
Well, the pandemic has hit Ukraine and Russia quite hard, particularly Russia. In fact, I think Russia has suffered a great deal from the various waves. There's been press coverage over time of, you know, how Russia has experienced similar types of backlogs in hospitals and severe challenges to its healthcare system. The pandemic has certainly hurt Russia's economy. And in fact, I think it is an indirect factor that, in my perspective, I think one of the reasons why this is coming up specifically now, although these grievances that Russia has against NATO are longstanding, and there's certainly no push right now quite the opposite to invite Ukraine to join NATO. So one could ask, why now? Well, one reason is that the Russian economy has really taken a beating, and the Russian society is very unhappy these days. COVID has played a great role in that. Russia has a very low vaccination rate. There's a lot of skepticism about the vaccine. The economic disruptions have been severe. And so one interpretation of Putin's recent actions is that in large part, they're motivated by desire to distract the Russian people from the domestic issues that face the Russian government and instead play to Putin's own strong hand, which he, I think, rightly perceives to be foreign policy and geopolitical confrontation with the West.
When you talk about economic disruptions, my mind goes to what about sanctions as a role the U.S. might put here? And when I think of sanctions, I think of trade restrictions or export controls. What are the U.S.'s options for sanctions against Putin that would hurt Russia financially or economically?
Well, there are a few things. So indeed, sanctions generally have been used by governments, including the United States, to punish states for bad behavior, but they haven't generally been understood as a tool for getting governments to change their behavior. They're sort of meant to symbolize and signify disapproval of certain actions. And there's been a lot of talk, a lot of controversy over whether or not sanctions that the United States imposed on Russia after 2014 have been effective in any way. So clearly they haven't changed the policy, but I actually subscribe to the view advanced by many economic conservatives that they have hurt Russia's economy. They have made life more difficult for Putin. And the new raft of sanctions that are being discussed are actually more extreme. So for one, they're talking about really going after some individuals, not sort of the typical kinds of trade restrictions and embargoes, but going after individual Russian oligarchs and making them feel pain from not being able to access their assets that are held abroad. Secondly, cutting Russia off from the global financial system, the so-called SWIFT system that banks use to transfer money back and forth, that will really, in the short term, have some very crippling consequences for the Russian economy. And third, there's talk of limiting or restricting exports to Russia of technology that Russia really needs, both for its oil and gas industry, on which it depends, but which is technologically somewhat behind, and also for its military. And so, you know, the idea is that the new sanctions will be new and stronger and more effective. Will that be actually be effective? Well, the answer is we just don't know. We may well find out, unfortunately.
Sociologist Ted Gerber with us, director of the Wisconsin-Russia Project for UW-Madison. Let's go to Josh now in Oak Creek. Hi, Josh.
Hey, how guys? I just want to point something out and get your guest comment on it. My worry is that this Ukraine thing is a subterfuge for getting our warships over there in the sea, getting our troops divided over there versus over here. And the reason I say that is throughout the last couple of years, you can go back in any media or not, and you will see that Russia and China have been doing military drills together. There's been evidence that they've been doing bombing runs on our warships. I don't think it's coincidence that we have two wannabe superpowers working together who don't exactly like us, and now we have this. And if we're going to call Putin standing on it or posing for it or not, I'm worried that that pose is exactly part of the game.
Josh, thank you. Josh, concerned about warships and aircraft getting into positions. Ted?
Well, I think, first of all, it's an excellent point that Russia and China have been cooperating much more closely in recent years. It's been part of Putin's reaction to pressure from the West after his 2014 incursions into Ukraine has been to pivot, as it were, towards China and to try to establish tighter relationships, including military relationships. It's an uneasy alliance somewhat because although China certainly perceives the U.S. as its major threat and is happy to have Russia as an ally, given Russia's military might, I think China also does not perceive Russia as offering much in terms of economic opportunities and economic growth. And China, although China is certainly eager to have Russian gas and oil, the Russians are quite sensitive to being treated with deference and respect. And so That alliance, while in the short term, it certainly poses probably the most significant challenge, in my view, foreign policy challenge to the United States. It's not necessarily one that will be durable, though we shall see. In terms of the question about exposing U.S. troops and ships, I don't think the level of commitment is sufficient to really motivate China and Russia. That is, so if the idea is that this is some kind of bait or some kind of ruse to get U.S. military equipment and troops into positions where they can be attacked, I think that's pretty unlikely. I think, you know, in the event, I don't think that Russia or China want to have a shooting war with the United States. Mm. I think they're calculating that the U.S. will not respond. And that's why they're using this opportunity to push what they perceive as their interests, because they don't think the U.S. is going to strike back militarily.
And Ted, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us. Ted Gerber, professor of sociology at UW-Madison, focusing on Russia, Ukraine, here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Head. Ahead this hour, we hear about a Racine program making art and museums more accessible to people who have memory loss. That's in about 15 minutes. But first, our country's millions of miles of roads are connecting people more than ever. But what about the animals that live around these thoroughfares? Research published in Landscape and Urban Planning found around 12% of North America's wild mammals die on roads. In some cases, roads cut off animals from migrating in winter. A form of infrastructure called wildlife crossings can help animals bypass those roads and reconnect wildlife populations. Patricia Kramer is a longtime wildlife researcher, and she spoke with WPR's Lee Rayburn.
Patricia, you've studied each state's data on car accidents involving wildlife. What did you find out specifically about Wisconsin and how it compares with the rest of the country?
Sure. Wisconsin, I looked at 5 years of crash data from your Department of Transportation through 2019, and Wisconsin averages over 20,000 reported crashes with wildlife each year. And that winds up being 16% of all your crashes. That's actually quite large. Most states have the number of recorded crashes with wildlife are well under 10,000. And the average of all the states is about 5% of all their crashes are with wildlife. So you very much have a problem there in Wisconsin.
I think anecdotally, we can all see it as we're driving down the roads at one point or another. But how are U.S. roads affecting animal interactions with the environments around them then, Patricia?
Well, as you see, roads can be pretty lethal because of the traffic on them killing the animals. They also create habitat fragmentation for the animals. We can see how a deer can't get to the other side of the road to access water or food. But there's also smaller animals like salamanders trying to migrate to a pond to lay eggs, or turtles, or black bear. Bear are known to be a bit more skittish of roads than other species of animals. So you may have your black bear restricted to one side or the other. So there's the ability to get to your kitchen, your bedroom, your backyard. For all these animals, if they're in an area with roads, those places are bisected with a bunch of vehicles coming through. So it affects the individual animals that you see, but then over time it can affect the populations, and you can lose those populations of animals.
So then what has the buildup of our road infrastructure over time across the country and here in Wisconsin meant for roadkill rates?
Well, I was just looking at your deer population. You're like, to give you an example, in Wisconsin, you have about 2 million deer, and 20,000 crashes is 1% of your deer population killed each year. I think the whitetail will always be okay. There's enough whitetail in our country that their numbers will survive with the crashes. However, when you get to more animals that are a little more rare, like even mule deer, their counterparts in the West, their numbers have been impacted by getting killed on roads. The numbers are much lower, but when you have a smaller number of animals, getting killed on the road can really affect the population. So, for instance, bighorn sheep are always under the pressure of crashes, even if it's just 5 a year in a particular population. If the population is only 25 to 50 animals,
it affects them. So we see the smaller populations of animals being much more affected. So there are somewhere around 14 to 17 endangered species that are somewhat affected by getting killed on roads. You can hear stories of Florida panthers. About 20 a year get killed on roads in southern Florida. So that actually winds up being one of the things that, that dampens the ability of that population to rebound, is that there's no place for them to go without some of them getting killed. So we definitely see the effect on the lower population number animals and the endangered and threatened species.
Patricia Kramer, our guest, wildlife researcher. And Patricia, it was in the mid-90s that I came across wildlife crossings for the first time. It was actually a frog tunnel in Davis, California. And I'm wondering what your research says about their effectiveness.
Oh, well, wildlife crossing structures work. And I will encourage anyone who doubts it or would like to see them in action, if you would go to YouTube and type in the words wildlife crossings. We do research here. Well, actually, I'm all over the country, but I have videos online for Utah wildlife crossings and Montana wildlife crossings. And you can see dozens to hundreds of animals, particularly deer, going through structures. There's also great videos by others showing some of the smaller animals, even down to groundhogs or squirrels going across structures, porcupine, skunks, moose. I even have photos of wolves using structures in Montana. So they very much work. If anyone is a naysayer, it's because they're not informed. But we know they work. There are some animals that are skittish. For instance, pronghorn, bighorn, and elk are the problem children. And you can get a couple of the boys to go through, but to get a herd of all of them with the matriarchs leading, they're very skittish, and we typically have to put in overpasses for them because they don't like to be restricted in their movements. And so what we do in our research with wildlife is we put cameras on the entrances to a lot of these structures and even existing bridges and culverts, and we see who goes through and who's skittish and doesn't want to. And then we compare the results and we tell the engineers, okay, length matters, which means don't make it a long, dark tunnel. Keep it high and wide and open, and you'll get a lot more of the animals. So they very much work for the animals they're designed for.
So the benefits for the animals and the animal population, quite clear. But what does the data say about what we've seen in terms of benefits for humans and our transportation systems?
So I went and added up the cost, the average cost of all the crashes that are reported with wildlife in Wisconsin, and it's over $263 million worth of crashes. So that's property damage, people's injuries, and the value of human lives lost. So if we put wildlife crossings in along with some fences to guide these bigger animals like your white-tailed deer, less people will get in crashes, less people will die, people will save money, maybe your insurance rates would go down, and you might be less fearful going out at dawn and dusk when these animals are out and about. So it winds up being a great win-win situation for everyone.
So, Patricia Kramer, if this is a win-win situation for everyone, why aren't there more of these crossings across the United States?
Well, because departments of transportation have evolved just providing transport for goods and services and people. And their mission statements do not say too much about the environment, connectivity for wildlife, you know, ecological reasons for doing things. And so we are asking departments of transportation to do something they haven't typically considered, and they have to say, well, there's many things we have to consider. So my mission in life is to change the mindset for them to do things that not only benefit wildlife, but will help the transportation department minimize crashes, so the safety aspect, as I've been saying, but also things like, okay, you need to plan for climate change and the water coming through a place like Wisconsin, the runoff in the spring is going to be in greater pulses, greater volumes. And so you need to be planning not just for culverts for water, but placing bridges that encompass more than the 100-year floodplain. And in turn, that will protect the infrastructure from being washed away by the flooding that might happen with climate change. And you might have terrestrial pathways along the stream that now the animals can use, and even people that are anglers can walk along underneath the road and don't have to pop up over it because it was just a culvert. So there's many small things you can do. And then when a big project comes along, like say four-laning a two-lane highway through a national wildlife refuge or a place where there's a lot of animals, we try to encourage the inclusion of wildlife crossing structures early in the planning. That is so critical, not 5 years down the line, but 15 years down the line, saying, hey, let's put in some bridges for wildlife to get underneath the road. So it's multifaceted, working with the transportation departments to consider this, which would save them money and make your road safer for you.
And finally, Patricia Kramer, beyond the intersection of our animals and our roads, what else do you see in your research that needs to be done to preserve wildlife?
Well, we all see development for human homes and subdivisions and box stores going in, and that is always kind of sad for those of us that love wildlife. So I think we need to be aware that we share this planet with a lot of other species that were here before we came and plopped ourselves down. And that means things like driving. I'm going to say this twice. I'll say it now and later. Drive with awareness that there are animals on the side of the road. If you see one deer coming out, there's a good chance she's got a fawn behind her or there's other deer. So slow down. Slow down and be aware. Especially in dawn and dusk, your commuting hours are the same hours the animals commute. Wisconsin has an incredible black bear population. Be aware that if you leave food out or you don't secure your garbage pails, the bears can get habituated to eating your food and may wind up dead. You know, a fed bear is a dead bear. Things like there's pollinators that are even in danger because of traffic. So bees, butterflies, and hummingbirds, you know, plant native flowers in your yard and vegetation that they could use. There's just all kinds of ways to try to bring things back to what it was before we brought ourselves and our infrastructure on the landscape. So being aware and making a wildlife-friendly backyard and keeping things from being attractants to animals that in turn could get them in trouble with humans are some of the big things that I see.
Patricia Kramer, thank you for sharing your research with us.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for your interest.
And that was wildlife researcher Patricia Kramer talking with WPR's Lee Rayburn. Coming up, we talk with the co-founder of an expanding program that aims to make art and art exhibitions accessible to people with early stage memory loss. Have you attended a SPARK program? What was that experience like? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us as we discuss a cultural program for people with early to mid-stage memory loss and their caregivers. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The program, it is called SPARK, and these SPARK initiatives are popping up at museums and art centers around Wisconsin and around the Midwest. Have you attended a SPARK program, maybe in art making or storytelling, drama, dance movement? What was it like? Join in 800-642-1234. Tricia Blasco is one of the co-founders of SPARK. She's also curator of education at the Racine Art Museum. Trish, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So your museum recently held a SPARK program for Racine area residents. Can you walk us through what the program was like?
Sure. So we've been doing this since 2010, and our programs are a good mix of sensory stimulants, but ours are really focused around the visual elements, as we are an art museum. So we always have a piece of art in the program or several pieces of art that we look at, we talk about, we engage with, and then we bring in other sensory activities to help stimulate various responses.
And the latest program was a virtual program. What effect has that had on as you try to put these programs together?
We were lucky to be able to pivot, as we all love to say, to doing virtual programs in 2020. And our participants have been really engaged with our virtual activities. They're a little different. You know, it's not the same as being here in person together, but we have the ability to create art kits with all kinds of art supplies and various, again, sensory stimulants that get dropped off by our wonderful volunteers to the participants' homes. And, you know, then each virtual program, again, consists of the same thing we do in person, but it has the ability to go virtual and it's kind of nice because we can add in a few more elements that we aren't able to do in person. We can show images from our collection and other art images around the world too.
Spark makes this really important distinction that it's not about recalling memories. It's not about reminiscing. It's you're really focusing, as what you're describing, on observations and creative experiences and conversations. Can you kind of tell us a little bit about that distinction between those two areas?
This program is definitely not a reminiscence program. We never ask the question, do you remember? It's about using imagination. It's about being in the moment. Often memories do come up and we certainly, you know, explore those more and talk about them. But, you know, we don't ever ask somebody to, you know, have these recall moments that might make them nervous if they don't remember what an object is or why they know what this object is or, you know, what, you know, this memory is referring to. So it's just important to have, you know, a variety of elements that help stimulate a response that's in the moment, that creates a new experience for the person with memory loss, for their care partner, their care families. And that's what we try to do in these programs.
Can you give us an example of that sensory stimulation, that sensory experience of a program that you might put on or a little moment that you might have your group experience?
Absolutely. So, you know, with each program, we try to bring in as much as we can. We often don't get to everything, mm-hmm. But we have a bag of tricks that we try to pull from. In the past program that we did in January, again, it went back to virtual just because of where we are in this day and age. And we were looking at still lifes. We have this wonderful exhibit called Watercolor Wisconsin. It's an annual exhibition that we have here at the Wisdom location. It's the 55th year. And there's a lot of still lifes in the exhibit, but there were a couple still lifes that were a little bit funky. So they had, you know, not just, you know, your typical flowers or fruit in the still life, but a kind of a interesting object. So in their box, we wrapped up a weird curiosity that they could unwrap and look at and touch and talk about. And then we also did put in apples, as often you will see many apples in still life paintings. And so, you know, everybody was able to touch the apple, feel it, talk about it, look at the color, smell it. You know, if they had the capability of biting into the apple, that was such a great sensory experience to hear the crunch and, you know, again, extending the smell through biting into the apple. So, you know, that's the kind of thing we'd like to throw together.
What have you learned about Spark over a decade and change of putting on these programs? What has emerged?
I think it's, you know, really about the person. You know, it's a person first program. We like to create the sense of community within, you know, within our small programs, but in a larger scale. We work with, you know, our 24 plus other cultural institutions and have a community within our educators, our peers. We've worked with a lot of other organizations to bring in experts and people that engage with people with memory loss in different ways, whether it's a poetry project or dance or time slips with Dr. Bastings out of Milwaukee. So, you know, it's creating community in a small way, but also on a very large scale.
Time slips, what is that about?
Time Slips is a program that started in Milwaukee. It started with Dr. Ann Basting. She is a MacArthur Fellow, and she started this program about beautiful questions. So asking, you know, for people with memory loss to look at an image and work one-on-one or in small groups to ask open-ended questions and create a story through those questions. And every answer is part of the story, even if it's a little bit off from what you thought the answer would be. So it's all about, you know, open questions and beautiful engagement. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of what we do within our programs, how we talk about art or talk about other elements that we bring in.
We're talking with one of the co-founders of Spark, Trish Blasco. The program is in 4 states, aims to make art and exhibitions accessible to people with early stage memory loss. Have you attended a Spark program in Wisconsin or in the Midwest? What was that experience like? Social workers, caregivers, what do you think helps people with memory loss? 800-642-1234 to join in. Trish, tell us about the reaction that you get from participants. How meaningful is the Spark program to the people who go to it?
I think it's probably one of the most amazing programs out there. And I'm not just saying that from the feedback I get from our participants. I often get emails or phone calls or letters from them afterward, you know, just saying that, maybe whatever we did in the program that day, they extended it and were able to do something else at home, or they talked about it with their kids or with their grandkids, or, sometimes we'll send extra materials home with the participants and they can, do it with their grandkids or with other people in their home. It's interesting because the sad part of this program is that people often age out of the program or they pass away, and it's very difficult. But as I said, we've created this family, this community, and the participants' care families are still invited to come back, and we see often repeat visitors after the person's loved one has died. So
that really shows how
powerful it is.
Yeah, you've really created a community around this program. If a museum wants to start a Spark program, what would be next steps? What should they be thinking about?
Absolutely. So they can contact me or my friend Dawn at the Milwaukee Public Museum, and we host a conference every year. This year it will be in November at the Schlitz Audubon Center, which is an amazing space for a conference of this nature. And we walk them through the whole process, what they need to do. We give them mentorships. They can touch base with their local ADRC or the Alzheimer's Association and get further training. But the conference that we hold every year is a really good start to creating a program. And again, we've created this really wonderful partnership with all these different institutions around Wisconsin and throughout the Midwest, so that there's opportunities to learn and to engage with, lots of other folks who are doing this.
Where do you think Spark goes from here? How do you want to see it look in the next years as you grow the program?
That's a great question. I think, with each program, the program is meant to be small and intimate, but I do think that we want to expand, and every institution should be doing a program like this. It doesn't have to be Spark, but something similar, because, it really transforms what the institution does. And it's always part of, art museums and other cultural institutions' missions to reach every person, with any kind of accessibility issues or, needs. So it's a great, way to, keep reaching different demographics.
Well, Trish, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Trish Blasco is a co-founder of the Spark Cultural Program for People with Memory Loss. She's also curator of education at the Racine Art Museum. We have a link to Spark. It's at wpr.org/mornings. Just ahead, a dentist shares tips for keeping our mouth and gums healthy. We hear about dentistry, navigating the pandemic, and then answer your questions about oral hygiene. Have you been avoiding the dentist? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.